when you talk to sewage workers, very often drunk while at work, they tell you their work is so humiliating and terrible that without drinking, they're not able to do their jobs.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In many developing countries, males in low-income jobs consume a lot of alcohol. This is bad news for them personally and also for their families. It makes them less productive at work, less able to plan for the future, and of course, poorer. So if this is the case, how can policy help these men and how effective would any intervention be? An experiment among rickshaw drivers in India attempted to answer these questions. Its surprising results have recently been published in the American Economic Review. And Frank Schilbach of MIT, the researcher who performed the experiment, is with me today. Frank, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I made some pretty broad statements about males drinking alcohol in a developing world and the consequences of this. What do we actually know about this?
This is a great question. So on the one hand, we have very little reliable data on alcohol consumption in developing countries, in particular since measuring how much people drink is very difficult. There are several reasons why these data may be unreliable or perhaps why they underestimate how people drink, which is, you know, people might underreport their drinking due to stigma. They might have like incomplete knowledge within households. Husbands and wives might not share how much they drink, in part because husbands don't want their wives to know how much they drink. And there's also obvious issues of imperfect recall. People might just not remember as well how much they have been drinking, especially after drinking a lot. Now, one can look at estimates of overall consumption. So since, you know, survey evidence is not great, so one could perhaps look at estimates of overall consumption, which often comes from production data, including sort of legal production and estimates of illicit production. If you look at these numbers, since not everybody drinks in all places, these numbers overall can be quite misleading. For example, if you look at overall alcohol consumption in India, which is about 4 to 6 liters per adult of pure alcohol per adult and year, that looks actually quite low compared to like places like the US or places in Europe.
Yes, it does.
It's about half as much as in the US. However, very few, or almost no women in India drink regularly. And even among men, only about a third or so drink, which then means that the ones who do drink, drink a lot. In addition, there's evidence of more drinking among men with lower education and lower income, which sort of suggests that heavy drinking is particularly prevalent among the poor. Now then, when you actually walk around in Chennai or in surrounding areas and talk to people, it does become absolutely apparent that heavy drinking is, in Chennai and in Tamil Nadu and other southern Indian states, is very common, especially among low-income workers.
And your experiment was with rickshaw drivers in Chennai. Can you describe the sorts of lives that they lead, the working conditions that a typical driver would have?
Yes. Driving a cycle rickshaw is very, very hard physical labor. You can think of this as a bicycle taxi that either transports passengers or cargo. When I say passengers, often this is multiple passengers, 3, 4, 5 people. I saw once like 10 school children in a passenger rickshaw, or it is very, very heavy cargo. So I tried this myself once and it's extremely tough, often because these rickshaws are fairly old. So it's really, really hard physical labor. Hard physical labor is very common among workers with low education, including construction workers, loadmen, and the like. So people are really doing tough physical labor. So a typical rickshaw driver in Chennai roams around in a certain part of Chennai, tries to find trips, or perhaps just stands in common areas and waits for people to transport them. So the typical rickshaw driver in Chennai is married, has a couple of children. They earn about 300 to 500 rupees per day. This was about like $5 to $8 per day, which is often their family income since their wives tend to not work outside the household for pay. Of that money, then they spend about 100 rupees per day on alcohol. If you do the math, that's about a quarter or perhaps like a fifth of their overall daily income that they spend on drinking.
So what is the hypothesis here about how their lives would improve if they were to drink less? I can see there are a couple of obvious dimensions in which their lives would improve.
Yeah, there's a large range of outcomes that one consider. The most obvious one, perhaps, given my previous answer, is that family resources are heavily affected, in part just mechanically by if you spend a fifth of your income on alcohol, if you do less of that, you'll have more money. Second, there could be effects of increased earnings, perhaps because people work more hours or more productive if they drink less, in particular since there's quite a bit of day drinking going on. So people are drunk while on the job, at least quite a few of the rickshaw drivers. In fact, I was breathalyzing rickshaw drivers at some point, and about half of the rickshaw drivers that I would stop during their regular work hours between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. had positive breathalyzer scores in the study.
Gosh.
So one broad set of outcomes is family resources. A second set of outcomes is family life and family happiness. While we don't have a lot of direct causal evidence, the correlational evidence that heavy drinking affects violence, in particular within families, is overwhelming. And when you talk to women, which I did a lot before I started my study, and ask them how their husband's alcohol consumption affects their lives, they would overwhelmingly say that it interferes with their family life in part because of violence, but in part because husbands are not the men that the women say they married. They're not really sort of an active member of the family in a sense of being like a good father, an example, not just because of the violence, but also just because people would come home drunk, not functioning particularly well. Third, there's potential impacts on decision-making, things like savings choices, doing risky choices and outcomes, purchasing insurance, a bunch of different outcomes. We think, you know, people might make better decisions if they are less inebriated. And finally, there are potential effects on long-run health. We know very clearly that alcohol affects people's health, in particular heavy drinking. So there's lots of concerns, which I don't measure, but you know, the health literature is very clear about them, that in the long run, drinking heavily every day is bad for your health in various ways.
So you designed an experiment to encourage these rickshaw drivers to drink less or not to drink. What did you do? It must have been quite difficult to design appropriate incentives.
Incentivizing people not to drink is tricky in general because first you need to measure it well. Now, you can't just ask people, if I told you I'm going to pay you £5 not to drink tomorrow and you're going to report back tomorrow, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to give me a truthful answer
yes.
in case you drank anyway because you just want the money from me.
Mm.
So now one option potentially is to use breathalyzers. Breathalyzers give you a very good answer to the question of whether somebody is concurrently drunk. So if I wanted to figure out whether you're drunk right now, of course, I can just breathalyze you and I get an answer to that. Breathalyzers can pick up whether you have been drinking during the past something like 6 to 10 hours, depending on how much you drank. So, you know, I can actually know pretty well whether you have been drinking earlier in the day. But of course, there's an obvious concern whenever I incentivize you potentially to have a zero breathalyzer score. You might just show up sober, I give you the money, and you straight go to the liquor store and use it to drink. So then I was aware of this issue at the time, but it's sort of in the absence of better measurement devices, I use breathalyzers anyway, because there's some evidence from other settings that incentivizing people not to use drugs can have benefits beyond the incentivized periods. That's to say, like once you incentivize people to not use drugs, they also use drugs less later in periods when they're not incentivized anymore. A second, I was very much interested in understanding the effects of reduced day drinking. So breathalyzers are good for that because you can just incentivize people to come to an office or in this case, our study office between 6 and 10 p.m. And when they're sober then, you know, that tells me that they have been drinking at least less or they have been not drinking in the afternoon of that particular day.
I was very struck reading the paper to find out that many of the men in the study, they wanted an incentive payment to discourage them from drinking, even when, if they were a part of the experiment, they could get that income guaranteed without any behavior change. What does this tell us?
My interpretation of this behavior is that they wanted to reduce their future drinking. That is to say, choosing the incentives means that they wanted to increase the price of future drinking, or they wanted to make it more attractive for them to be sober in the future. Economists call this demand for commitment, which reveals self-control problems related to drinking. Let me explain a bit. If you want your future self to drink less, that means essentially you realize that your current self and your future self might make different decisions. So right now you might say, in the future, I would like to drink less. You could say that for other things. You would say, in the future, I might go to the gym more. I might want to smoke less. I might want to eat more healthily and so on. So we tend to want our future selves to be more virtuous than we are in the present. Now, once the future actually arrives, you might give in to temptation. You might sort of say, well, just today I might drink. Just today I might not go to the gym. I might want to eat potato chips. So there's a discrepancy what the current self wants and what the current self wants their future self to do. Now, understanding that, the current self then can demand commitment devices. These are devices that change the prices of the future, of future behaviors. In particular, they make behaviors that we don't want us to do in the future more costly. And this is exactly what I was offering to people, essentially, to increase the price of day drinking. If you chose the incentives and then were day drinking in the future, that meant essentially you were losing out on money. The evidence that I find is that people are willing to pay as much as 10% of their daily incomes for like a week each. So people were making choices for 1 week each. And they're willing to give up 10% of their daily income to set themselves incentives in the future. So that is to say, in the best case scenario where they have the incentives, so if you choose these incentives versus money that doesn't depend on your drinking at all, if you choose these incentives and show up every day and the following week sober, you would still lose 10% of your daily income compared to the other option of having unconditional payments. So that really means that a fraction of people have a huge desire to increase their sobriety in the future, which reveals self-control problems on their part in a sense that they want to reduce their future drinking, but they realize that they have trouble implementing that on their own in the absence of receiving such incentives.
And how well did the incentives that you offered work in changing the amount that they drank?
First, let me say these incentives are fairly steep. These are about 60 rupees for being sober. So the way this worked would be if you come to the office, you get an amount of show-up fee to just showing up, about $1. And then if you, in addition, have a zero breathalyzer test, you would get an additional $1 on top of that. So since I told you previously, people earn about $5 to $8 per day, that's a huge incentive for being sober, in addition to alcohol prices being relatively high compared to people's income anyway. So these are very steep incentives. Now, these incentives are quite effective in reducing day drinking. I told you previously that about half of the drivers were inebriated to some extent, at least during the day, during regular work hours. So that day drinking fell by about a third. So people, instead of drinking 3 standard drinks per day, they reduced that to 2 standard drinks on average. The fraction of people who arrived at the study office inebriated fell by about a third as well, by about 13 percentage points, which is quite large. So the incentives were indeed effective in reducing people's day drinking. And this is in some ways not surprising. We know that once you increase prices, people will drink less. We know that from a large range of studies from other settings. However, I also find that these incentives were not effective at all in reducing overall drinking. So what people seem to have done is they did reduce their drinking during the day, but then shifted their drinking to later times of the day, often at 7, 8, 9 p.m., such that their overall drinking changed only minimally. There was no significant reduction in people's overall drinking.
So if we're just shifting the time at which people drink, did these changes lead to better financial productivity outcomes for them?
Well, this is not a policy to reduce overall drinking, which in some sense I set out to try and understand. Are there some policies that might reduce people's overall drinking? It is a very good setting to study the effects of day drinking on people's work outcomes. And second, the effects of current inebriation of people being drunk versus not at a given point in time on their decision making. So I studied 2 types of main effects in the study. One is people's work outcomes. Surprisingly, I find no evidence that the incentives increase people's earnings, their labor supply, how many hours people worked, or their productivity, how much they earned per hour worked. This is surprising because it's very sort of intuitive to think that when people are fairly drunk, and these are pretty high inebriation levels that people had to start with, that might interfere with their work outcomes. You might think, you know, you can't navigate as well. It might be harder for you to get trips from people. You know, as a passenger, you might not want to have a drunk driver. Or, you know, if you want to somebody to transport your cargo, you also don't want to have a drunk driver. So I find no effects of these incentives of increased sobriety on people's work. People do seem to earn a little bit more, but the effects are by no means statistically significant, and they're also like relatively small in magnitude. In contrast, I find very large effects on people's savings. So I had offered as part of the study, people had been offered the opportunity to save money at the study office, and they would receive a very large matching contribution for however much they had saved by the end of the study. So if you had saved 100 rupees by the end of the study, you would get 10 or 20% that was randomized as a matching contribution for having saved that money by the end of the study. So I find large effects, 50% increase relative to the control group, of the incentives on people's savings behavior. Now, importantly, these effects don't seem to be just purely mechanical in the sense of, like, if you drink less, you might have more money available, perhaps because you work better or because you just save money from spending it on alcohol. But instead, it seems to be even conditional on the amount of money that people earned and had available after drinking, savings went up. How do I know that? Well, I told you already that people's overall drinking did not increase. Therefore, their expenses on drinking also did not increase. Second, there were essentially no positive impacts on people's earnings. So it's also not that people had more money available from work due to these incentives. So that makes me think that the increase in savings are at least in part explained by changes in decisions, in particular changes in patience. People seem to be more patient. People seem to be able to think more about the future. And there's a literature, in fact, that's very much consistent with that. That's called alcohol myopia. So alcohol makes people focus on the present, on what's salient and simple, as opposed to for the future. And savings is clearly one outcome that is very future-oriented and therefore affected by people's drinking or inebriation.
Were you surprised by these effects, Frank?
I was very surprised by the effects on people's productivity and earnings. In fact, when I started the study, this was sort of part of my PhD thesis at Harvard, quite a few people, when I sort of proposed the study in the first place, were telling me that it's obvious it affects people's earnings and productivity. And in some way, I thought that as well. It's kind of pretty obvious when people are drunk that might be bad for their earnings or their productivity. Now, when you think about this more carefully and ask people how alcohol affects their work, it's actually not that obvious at all. So I mentioned to you previously that people engage in very, very hard physical labor. It's also known that alcohol has a very powerful anesthetic properties. That is to say, alcohol is a very effective painkiller. Now, if people have lots of pain at work and alcohol helps them with their pain once they start drinking less, you know, it's just much more difficult to work, and therefore you might work less or like just might be less productive at work. And so in retrospect, I can sort of explain the lack of these effects on productivity and earnings by, you know, these contradictory effects. On the one hand, you might be better to navigate or you might be a more attractive driver if you're less drunk. On the other hand, it might be just a lot more painful to do work. If these two effects might cancel each other out, which I can explain the lack of overall effect on people's earnings.
Could we scale up an intervention like this effectively, practically, to make it into a permanent incentive? And given that the results were unexpected, do we really know enough about the role of alcohol in the lives of people like rickshaw drivers in Chennai that means that we could plan effective policies around it?
So this is a tricky question. So first, to answer your second question, we absolutely do not know enough of alcohol or other drugs in the lives of the poor. We don't really know why are people drinking. What I'm telling you about physical pain, for example, is very much sort of hypothesized in the sense of that's what people say when you ask them. That could be partially physical pain, but it could also be psychological pain. Reducing people's physical pain could really have stark effects on people's drinking, but really we don't know that. Similarly, reducing their psychological pain might work as well. For instance, when you talk to sewage workers, which are very often drunk while at work, they tell you their work is so humiliating and terrible that without drinking, they're not able to do their jobs. So now if we could in some ways improve their job conditions, or for some rickshaw drivers or other workers who have hard physical labor and have lots of physical pain from work, if we could reduce their pain in some way, perhaps that could be an effective policy to reduce their drinking. But that's speculation. We really don't have evidence for that, and we'd have to do a lot more work to figure out these types of questions. Now, let me sort of speak specifically to the first question you asked about, what about this specific policy that I was trying? So on the one hand, the intervention itself should not be scaled in its form unless you have a very high valuation of reducing day drinking. So in some settings, you might care a lot about day drinking. In my setting, it's not like there's lots of crashes or like it's very dangerous to day drink as a cycle rickshaw driver, in part because these drivers would drive really slowly. In other settings, you might actually care a lot more about day drinking, and then perhaps a form of the intervention that I was doing might be worth engaging in. Now, a key issue that we already discussed is the issue of being able to incentivize people appropriately. And breathalyzers have this key problem that you have to catch people at a certain point in time, and they might sort of be able to game these incentives in some ways by just drinking after being breathalyzed. I'm currently considering some higher tech devices that can actually measure people's drinking continuously and passively. So for instance, there are some wrist monitors that measure drinking through one's sweat. So what they do is every half hour or so, they suck in a little bit of air from your wrist and then can detect how drunk you are, at least approximate that pretty well. So my understanding is that these devices start to work quite well. They're still being developed and in progress, but I'd love to understand whether some of such devices could help overcome the incentives issues that we just discussed. So there's the potential for using better commitment devices if you want better ways to incentivize people that might help better. In addition, given the evidence of self-control problems, some state or other governments who set the prices or have pretty high taxes on alcohol anyway could consider increasing alcohol prices further. The reason for that is that, like, usually the elasticity of drinking, how much drinking falls once you increase prices, tends to be fairly low. The government could actually get more revenue and people's drinking would go down. That could have quite a bit of benefits, in particular for people's health and family lives and so on, and we should absolutely study these consequences. But if there's sort of one thing we know in general is that increasing prices is effective in reducing people's drinking. Now, there's two issues with that. One is illicit brewing, that people might just sort of start brewing the alcohol on their own, and that might have bad effects. So one would have to sort of try to monitor that. Second, it's regressive. The poor, since they spent more on alcohol as a share of their income to start with, would have a particularly high burden from that, from those kinds of taxes, and one would have to find some way of compensating them. But that's sort of like a policy that one could think about. There's also often discussion in India about prohibition. Now, when I say that to like Americans or people from other countries, people are often shocked, and the reaction is that prohibition doesn't work, and it's sort of, we tried this and it's a terrible idea. And of course, there are potentially lots of negative effects of prohibition that were documented in the US experience. However, you know, there are some states, in fact, that have prohibition in India with quite a bit of support, partially from women, but also by quite a few men who want prices of alcohol to be high. To be clear, I'm not arguing in favor of prohibition. I am perhaps arguing for thinking about higher prices, and a prohibition is like an extreme case of that. I'd love to find out some ways to, in fact, studying prohibition as it is done in various states in India, which would help us learn a lot more about sort of the real world effects, the effects outside of like a relatively small study that I was doing of reduced alcohol consumption on the lives of the poor in various ways, including families and their lives, including earnings, productivity, and so on. But also poverty as a whole. Would poverty levels go down, for example, if alcohol was less available?
Well, it might be a small study, as you say, Frank, but it is a fascinating insight into what we know, what we think we know, and what we should really know more about. So, Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tim.
The paper we've been discussing is called Alcohol and Self-Control, a Field Experiment in India, and the author is Frank Schilbach. It was published in the American Economic Review in April 2019 and is available from the AER as a free download. This has been a VoxDev Talk. You can find more of our episodes at voxdev.org, and don't forget to subscribe to VoxDev Talks on your podcast platform.